One of them wanted to be the security guy. He claimed he was a security guy.
Hey, welcome to another exciting adventure of Security Guy Radio in our brand new studio. Hopefully, this recording will go out and stay solid the entire time. So we're going to talk today about the Apple iPhone, well, not really a hack, but the ransomware. And you guys probably heard about it if you have Apples, which was your first problem, by the way, to have an Apple, but that's nothing I can do about.
One of them wanted to be a security guy. Claimed he was a security guy.
That's a big amount of money, which almost made it sound more legitimate or something. I'm not really sure. So we're going to talk today with an expert who knows way more about this than I do. That's usually the case on the show. So welcome, I guess. Let me make sure I can push this button here and get him on deck. All right, here we go. There's our guest. Oh, and I pushed the wrong button. Look at that. Schumann, are you still there?
I am.
All right, here we go. There he is. All right, welcome to the show, Schumann. Schumann,
thank you.
Stand by. I'm going to say this. I'm going to get it right. Schumann, not Schumann. Guzmanjumer. No, I got it wrong.
That's right.
Darn it. All right, you go ahead. Say it. Say it for me.
It's Schumann Guzmanjumer.
Guzmanjumer. It's so much easier when you say it. So much better. Welcome to the show. We're so glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Your company is Shape. The name of your company is shapesecurity.com, and one of your people contacted me because you had an interesting take on this Apple iPhone thing, and I want to talk about that, and then we'll talk about some other things in the security industry. So for people that don't know much about it, give us your thumbnail sketch of what happened, how this all got set up, and a latest update if you happen to have one.
Sure. So a couple of weeks ago, there were a bunch of articles that got published about a group that identified itself as the Turkish crime family holding Apple for ransom, saying that they had hundreds of millions of iCloud accounts and they were going to delete them unless Apple paid them a ransom. And the value of the ransom was actually reported in varying sums between $75,000 and hundreds of thousands of dollars, but they set this deadline of April 7th for Apple to comply, and everyone was waiting until April 7th to see exactly what would happen, and Apple just introduced or sent out some terse statements saying that they hadn't been breached, and they were working with law enforcement to be able to figure out who was behind this and how to go after them. But when April 7th came around, what ended up happening was the perpetrators claimed that Apple had actually paid them a ransom, and they sent out a link to a Bitcoin transaction in the amount of more than $400,000. And then there was even more confusion that was generated in terms of whether or not this was legitimate. And of course, with Bitcoin, it's very difficult to be able to know whether or not this is a legitimate version of events that the so-called Turkish crime family is conveying. But one thing is clear, and that is that the source of the accounts that they were using or referring to were not coming from a breach of Apple systems themselves, and that was what Apple wanted the world to know. So how is it that you can take over some number of iCloud accounts? Because in fact, the press articles were able to confirm that the Turkish crime family had legitimate usernames and passwords that could be used to access iCloud accounts. How could you do that without breaching Apple systems? And the answer is because of all of the third-party breaches which had occurred over the course of the last several years. So because of the fact that there are usernames and passwords that are available from data breaches on unrelated sites, when users reuse those same passwords on their iCloud account, now all of a sudden their iCloud account is vulnerable, even though Apple's security controls haven't necessarily been broken. So this really represents a new type of attack that we've been seeing for a number of years now, and it's really escalated as a result of all of the data breaches that have occurred as well.
All right, so what's up with this Bitcoin stuff? All right, so why would they ask for Bitcoin? I mean, I guess because they don't have to be touched. It's they're not connected and so on. But isn't Bitcoin really gotten some kind of really bad reputation now for being part of the underworld?
Well, it's definitely strongly associated with underworld transactions. And the reason for that is because it provides anonymity in those transactions. It's no surprise that they would ask for the ransom in Bitcoin. That really is the currency of the cyber criminal underworld.
Well, why not 75 million? I mean, it's fake money. We have a little lag. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, when I heard this, I thought 75,000. I thought it sounded more legitimate to me because it was 75,000. Does that make sense? In other words, they're not asking for $1 bazillion. They're asking for a smaller amount, and you know, maybe they're a couple of kids, and that's a lot of money to them. But that didn't necessarily have anything to do with it. And by the way, what did happen? Did anything happen at all?
So it's unclear exactly what happened. Apple has not clarified what's happened. The Turkish crime family's version of events is almost impossible to be able to verify. But when I heard the $75,000 figure, I thought that one of two things were going on. Either this is a group that is really unsophisticated and doesn't know what it's doing and doesn't have the value of these accounts correct, or it actually doesn't have anything at all and is trying to hold Apple for ransom based on a completely false threat. But there's another possibility, which is the fact that they were trying to do something even more sophisticated. And, you know, we don't know exactly what that incentive could be. But the fact that they were trying to generate so much attention for themselves indicated that one possibility is they're trying to change public perception around Apple by embarrassing them in some way. There's, of course, other possibilities as well. Like you said, it could be a couple of kids that are just doing it to amuse themselves or for the lulz. And I think that when I heard the figure itself, one of the things that it made me think of was the Austin Powers movies and how you don't take the world's most valuable company and ask them for just $75,000 if you're going to publicly hold them for ransom. You'd ask for a lot more money regardless of you know, what your scheme was and what the value of accounts that you actually had was. But if you look at the value of iCloud accounts in underground markets, you see that it's a lot higher. If they actually had hundreds of millions of iCloud accounts that they could breach, then we're talking about something that is worth hundreds of millions of dollars as opposed to just the small amount of money. Even the higher sums that were reported in the press were still less than $1 million. So it's kind of unclear what sort of cyber criminal these folks are.
Now, the other thing I found interesting was that I thought... get the right name on the screen here while I'm talking. They said that, yes, they stole some stuff from probably LinkedIn and Yahoo and all that kind of stuff, but you don't really have to steal people's passwords. Talk to us about how, if you have a computer and a program, you can just run 1 million words in a dictionary through the system, and it's going to hit on some kind of password, like password 01 or tennis shoes or something like that. And that's another trick these guys are using to get these passwords, isn't that right?
You know, they have used techniques like this in the past, and most commonly when they do that sort of attack, which is known as a brute force attack, what they're doing is they're trying to figure out what the passwords were from a given data set that they might have stolen from a place like LinkedIn. So the way that that works is that there are various mechanisms that are used, various algorithms that are used to be able to protect the passwords even when they're in one organization's data store. And when you as a cyber criminal get access to that data store, now all of a sudden you've got an additional task that you have to complete, which is being able to get the passwords out of the hashed form. And if they're stored using a weak form of hashing, then you have a greater likelihood of being able to get it out with whatever computational resources you have access to. Now, the problem is that once you've actually gotten those passwords out, or if you've gotten access to a set of usernames and passwords where you don't even have to complete that step, now you can use those credentials to be able to attack all of the other sites on the internet in what's known as a credential stuffing attack. And this has become the most common form of attack that we see on user account systems, on websites, as well as on mobile applications. So the problem is that everyone has many different accounts, and they have typically more than 40 or 50 accounts across various internet sites. And it's really difficult to be able to manage all the passwords that are associated with those accounts. So people tend to reuse the same passwords. When they reuse those passwords, it makes it easy for the cyber criminal to be able to access not necessarily their account, but to be able to access a certain number of accounts on any system that they're attacking where there's a predictable rate of password reuse. So what we see at Shape is credential stuffing attacks that come in with usernames and passwords stolen from one place, like the LinkedIn breach, that are simply logging in to a completely unrelated site to be able to see which accounts also exist between the LinkedIn breach as well as the system that they're attacking. And then within those accounts, which of those accounts are reusing the same passwords. And blended together, we typically see between a 0.1% and 2% success rate. So what that means is if you've got a cyber criminal that has a million usernames and passwords that they've stolen from site A, when they use that to be able to log into all of the accounts on site B, they're typically going to be able to take over tens of thousands of accounts with relative ease. And they won't know which accounts they're able to take over until they execute that credential stuffing attack. But that's really the difference between the attacks we see today and the attacks that we would see in the past, where they would take that sort of brute force attack, like we were just discussing, and not just run it on a stolen set of hashed passwords, but run it against the login form of a website. And that sort of attack has now been obsoleted in the sense that most major web services and mobile APIs will lock out anyone who's trying to log into a given account too many times within a certain period of time. So if you have three incorrect guesses of your password on a given username, it's pretty common to see that you're not allowed to log in again for 24 hours. That's a pretty standard sort of control. And because of that, the attackers have now switched to executing these credential stuffing attacks on websites and APIs.
Now, this is really interesting to me. I hear what you're saying. I have 9 social media sites. And I don't know, I just figured this out intuitively a long time ago. I never use the same password for any site. So I got 9 social media sites. I have, you know, you got banks, you have all these things. And I, for sure, I have 50 things I log into. And I just came up with an idea for an acronym. And I use an acronym and a combination. Wait a minute, I shouldn't be saying this on radio, should I? Anyway, I am very careful with my passwords. And I don't have the same password for every site. And I use two-way authentication. But even so, I was hacked on Facebook last year. And I'm not sure how that happened because maybe I didn't have the two-way authentication on. But this is a big problem. We were talking before the show. I went to Black Hat in Vegas, and I did about 41 shows. And each provider I spoke with had a different part of the internet they were working on, a different solution. And it was just fascinating, the brain power in that room and what they're trying to do to combat this stuff is just fascinating to me. So I want to know what Shape Security does. So give me some information on Shape Security, and tell me what it is you specialize in, because the way you just described that whole Apple hack to me was brilliant and simple. And I know that Tina, the soccer mom across the street from me, is going to understand it, as well as the high level people.
So we protect against exactly these types of attacks. So because it's become commonplace for cyber criminals to get usernames and passwords from one site and test them against other sites, we see this being responsible for actually not only the vast majority of the attacks on user account systems leading to account takeovers, but actually responsible for the vast majority of login traffic on many of the world's largest sites. So for example, on some of the world's leading brands that we protect, we saw that more than 90% of all of the login activity was actually coming from credential stuffing attempts, as opposed to coming from legitimate users attempting to log into their accounts.
90%?
More than 90%, that's right.
Wow.
And that was very eye-opening for us as well as for our customers, because they had every type of security control in place. So if you're one of the world's largest companies, you're not just sitting by and letting security issues happen to you and letting cyber criminals attack you. You're investing in security controls, and you're buying things like web application firewalls, and you're investing in fraud and analytical tools, and building up your fraud teams and security teams and networking teams. And it was companies like these that were actually experiencing such high levels of credential stuffing attacks, even with all of those controls in place. And the reason for this was because of the fact that credential stuffing is really a new form of attack that doesn't register like a typical security vulnerability that's being taken advantage of by the attackers. In this case, they're simply taking advantage of the fact that you have a login form, which anyone on the internet from any IP address on any machine can use if they have the valid credentials to be able to access a given account. And so when they do that, it just looks like a popular day on their website if they're going through millions of different username and password combinations, because they only have to log into each account once. So if one of these companies has a promotion, for example, if they have a nationwide television ad, then they might see millions of their users log into their account over the course of the next few days. And in fact, that's exactly what a credential stuffing attack looks like.
So talk to me about how you handle this in real time. Now, let's define real time, because I had 40 different definitions of that at Black Hat. There's real time, and then there's kind of real time, and then there's a week delay, but that's real time because there was a billion transactions. What does real time mean to Shape Security that helps you monitor and take care of this?
So real time has a very precise definition for us, and that's happening at the moment that you see a transaction. But in order to be able to protect against these types of attacks, you have to deal with them not only in real time, but across that spectrum, across that time continuum that you just described. So there are certain types of activity that you're going to be able to identify in real time in the context of an individual transaction. There are other types of activity that you're only going to be able to identify when you see a set of transactions together, and then you're able to identify patterns that span across those transactions. So you have to be able to analyze data in all of the different forms in which it's coming into your system. And what we've built at Shape is a platform that makes it possible for anyone to be able to get the benefits of that sort of analysis that can happen in each of those time stages. So we look at every single transaction that's coming into something like a login form in real time, in near real time, and we look at it across a much longer time period using longitudinal analysis and offline algorithms. So that allows us to see if there's a pattern that emerges when you look at 100 transactions together, or 1,000, or even a million transactions together, and allows you to see patterns that emerge when you compare transactions from one company to the patterns in transactions from another company, in the sense that you can see similar sorts of attack tools that get used across the internet.
Now, I want to hear about your street creds. You have some serious street creds, and I'm not going to get it wrong by saying what you did at Google, but I want you to explain that. But you seem very young to have this background. Of course, I have white hair, so I look like I'm 100 years old, everybody. But tell us about your background. You know, I'm really interested in this from you, because you're a chief technology officer. You're fairly young. I'm sure you started young, right? And there's a huge shortage of people like yourself in the IT business. There's a million people shortage in the world today. We need a million more people in IT, and we don't have them. So I'd be very curious to see what your background is, how you got into this, what inspired you to do it. So the floor is yours. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not that young. I also have white hair. Maybe you can't see it as well in this lighting, but that's good. I'm happy for that. I've been doing this for more than 20 years, and what I did at Google prior to Shape was directly related in the sense that we also dealt with large-scale automated attacks and automated fraud. And in the context of Google, it was specifically click fraud. So Google's business model was based on pay-per-click advertising. And if you, as a cyber criminal, could generate fraudulent clicks, then you had the opportunity to be able to get money out of Google and Google's advertisers. So we built large-scale systems using machine learning and many other approaches to be able to identify the patterns that were associated with fraudulent clicks and protect our advertisers and our advertising system, which at the time was more than $20 billion a year in pay-per-click advertising against those types of attacks. So what we've done at Shape is sort of created a generalized version of that kind of approach, sort of inspired by the same sorts of issues, because we realize that every single company has these types of concerns when it comes to their particular business model. So whether it's an attack on an account system or it's an attack on their flight search mechanism in the case of airlines, or inventory search in the case of hotels and retailers. There are many different ways that automation is used to be able to attack the world's leading brands. And because of the fact that the attackers are so sophisticated, you have to be similarly sophisticated in the platform that you create to be able to deal with those.
Now, that's an interesting point. I've always talked to people. When I worked at the studios, I worked with the IT department a lot because we had probably, you know, a fairly good-sized budget, right? And we could build things and we could say, okay, you know, I don't have a database. I don't have a way to search this database. Let me go build one. Let me go hire a guy, come in. And we used to do things like data mining back in the 90s, 96, 97, where I would take 350,000 phone numbers and put them in a database, and then I'd match it against something in Recycler, right, for some stolen articles. And we said, hey, there's one phone number in the Recycler newspaper that matches, you know, an ad for this stolen piece of property we have. And we caught people that way. But what I found with the IT people is that they couldn't do what I did, and I couldn't do what they did. In other words, it was a combination of me knowing what bad guys are and how bad guys work and how bad guys think, and working with the IT people to give me a solution. So they would find the data. They didn't know what it meant, and then we worked together as a team. Are you seeing this merging of law enforcement and physical security coming back? Because for a while, it used to be they were hiring, you know, IT guys, CTOs to run physical security and cybersecurity. I'm not sure that model works. You really need both those people to understand how it works. What's your experience in that?
I agree with you. I think that you have to have both of those disciplines, as well as other disciplines, work together in order to be able to deal with very sophisticated cyber criminals. So just the same way as when you're dealing with a certain type of fraud, you have to be able to understand all of the dynamics that are associated with the industry in which that fraud is occurring, in addition to understanding the criminal's mindset. In the case of cybercrime, you need to be able to understand the tools that are used, the various techniques that technology enables. You have to understand the industry in which the attacks are occurring, and you need to be able to understand the cyber criminal's mindset and stitch all of those together in order to be able to create a unified team that is going to have real insights in terms of how do you stay ahead of those types of cyber criminals. And I think that it's really challenging to be able to do that. You have to have folks that have completely complementary backgrounds, working very closely together and educating each other constantly in order to be able to get to the point that you're able to be more sophisticated than those cyber criminals. And of course, the cyber criminals have the most direct incentive to be as sophisticated as possible in their approaches.
What do you think about this shortage of qualified IT people? And I don't mean the guy that does, Windows desktop and has a certificate. That used to be considered an IT guy back in the 90s, right? Oh, I went to Windows school and I have a certificate. We have a lack of some serious knowledge. People aren't entering the field. It's a well-paid field. What do you think is making people not get into it? What I hear is, it's a difficult field to work in because of the pressures and how it's managed and who runs it and all that kind of stuff. And some people just leaving. But I heard a statistic at one of the trade shows that a million people short, and it has zero unemployment in that field. Do you experience any of those problems with your company? Or even with Google? Did Google have that problem?
Oh, it's incredibly difficult to be able to hire the best people and in some cases hire people at all in various technology fields these days. It doesn't surprise me that there continue to be shortages. And if you're in certain subfields like cybersecurity, it really is a great market as a job seeker right now. But I think that it's a temporary situation. I think that people are starting to understand how much opportunity there is in IT and in cybersecurity specifically. And because of that, there are more and more students that are studying these subjects in school. And over time, they're just very naturally going to produce many more people in the workforce.
I'm a little concerned that it may be putting us at risk. And I just think like a good old-fashioned street cop that worries about the barbarians at the gate and, you know, that kind of thing. Because if we have a million people short, and we, in other words, that puts extra pressure on the existing system, do you see us being extra vulnerable because of that personnel shortage?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, especially when you're talking about cybersecurity, having a shortage does put you at risk, and it puts society at risk. And that's one of the reasons that there is so much opportunity when it comes to folks that have a cybersecurity background. But I think that it also creates opportunity for technologies to be able to fill that gap. So there's a certain amount that you can accomplish using manual effort, using known techniques based on hiring individuals to be able to implement those best practices at various companies. But if you don't have that opportunity, if you've got a fundamental shortage in the system, then the only way to be able to fill that is by innovating even more when it comes to technology and allowing the same number of people to be able to have a much greater effect.
So we have a few minutes left, and I'd like you to give us your best practices to all my misinformed friends who bought an Apple. Sorry, I'm a Samsung Droid guy. I have to admit it. I bought an Apple for one day because I bought this whole editing system, and I took it all back. I couldn't use it. It wasn't intuitive enough. But give the folks at home, the average person, some tips on how to make that password a little better and guard against some of these hacks.
Well, I think that there are a few different things that everyone should do right away. So the first thing is don't reuse your passwords across multiple sites. And when I've given this advice before, I've had a multitude of different reactions. In some cases, people accept that even though they're not doing that right now, even though they're not preventing themselves from reusing their passwords right now, they know that they should stop doing that. In other cases, they say, oh, there's no way that I'm going to be able to stop doing that. And there's no way we're going to be able to get society to stop doing that. And I agree, it's really challenging to get everyone or even a very large number of people to fundamentally change their behavior in anything, but particularly in an area like how they manage their passwords on various online accounts, which is already complex enough. So I think an easier way to be able to accomplish the same end is to use a password manager. So there are unquestionably attacks on password managers that have been demonstrated. But for the vast majority of people, if you're using a password manager, you're going to be safer and better off than if you're not. So a password manager, amongst other things that it will do, will generate a unique password on every single account system for you. And that prevents any attacker from gaining access to an account simply by virtue of the fact that they accessed a password from an unrelated account and then used a credential stuffing attack on another one of your accounts to be able to get access to it. So that's the first thing that everyone should do. Either stop reusing their passwords or use a password manager. And using a password manager is probably the easiest way to do it. Second thing that
Excellent.
Everyone... Sorry?
Go ahead.
So the second thing that everyone should do is enable two-factor authentication on all of the systems that either make it available as an option or the systems that they're concerned about a cyber criminal potentially taking over their account on. So if you've got a system that has two-factor authentication enabled, but it doesn't have anything of value for you, then you don't necessarily have to go through the trouble of enabling it. But presumably, you don't want any attacker taking over any of your accounts. So if two-factor authentication is available as an option, particularly for the accounts that you care about, you should definitely enable it. And what it will do is prevent an attacker who merely has a valid username and password for that account from being able to log in unless they also have your mobile device. And the odds of them having that are, of course, much, much lower. So there are accounts or there are attacks that have been demonstrated and have been observed that take over the mobile device at the same time as they have a username and password that they're using in a credential stuffing attack. But those are much smaller in terms of how many accounts those log into on the internet overall relative to the more common credential stuffing attacks that we see. So enabling two-factor authentication is something that everyone should look at. And finally, I think that one message that has sunk in for everyone over the years, regardless of whether or not they're actually implementing it, is they should use a difficult-to-guess longer password. So if you've got a password that is simply more characters and isn't using standard dictionary words, then an attacker that is using a brute force attack or a dictionary attack and just going through various words in the dictionary or guessing all of the possible combinations of letters and numbers that their computer is programmed to be able to guess, they're not going to be able to figure out what your password is as quickly. Now, if you're using a password manager, it's going to generate a hard-to-get password for you automatically. So that's yet another benefit of using a password manager. And finally, I think that whenever you read about data breaches or you read about credential stuffing attacks, you might think, what can I do as a consumer to be able to protect myself against something which really took advantage of the way that users in general, not necessarily my account, but other users' accounts are set up on various systems around the internet. And what you can ask for is that companies that you do business with have invested properly from a security perspective. You can demand that as a consumer, and you can choose to do business with companies that have strong track records when it comes to security. And I think that that is increasing over time in terms of consumer pressure, and companies realize that these sorts of data breaches are very damaging, not only from the point of view of the harm that it creates on the accounts that are taken over and money that might get stolen, but on their overall brand. So they want to be able to invest in security technologies and processes to avoid that type of public harm.
Shuman Gusmanjumder. Wait, Gusmanjumder. Say it, please. I'm going to get it right. I apologize. I will get it right next time. Shuman, this has been an excellent, excellent show. It's been very, very interesting. I really thank you for coming on. You want to come on again and tell us the latest breach that happens next week? You're welcome at any time. So thanks for coming.
Much.
ShapeSecurity.com. Yeah, ShapeSecurity.com is where you can find Mr. Shuman. So check out his website. And stand by because we're going to go one more show here at 7:30. And then we'll see you next week. For another exciting episode of Security Guy Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks very much.